Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court.
Certainly.
My name is John Campbell. I represent the appellant, Jody Nevels. For over 100 years, Missouri law prohibited insurers from subrogating or seeking reimbursement from insurance proceeds that an insured received from a third party. And in Nevels 1, this court ruled that policy was not preempted by the Federal Employee Health Benefits Act. Court held that it wasn't preempted, applying the presumption against preemption and concluding that the narrower reading was in fact required by constitutional principles, and also concluded in a footnote, anticipating the only new issue in this case, that OPM had no delegated authority to say otherwise. So the narrow question that comes before this court in Nevels 2 is, can OPM, through rulemaking, overrule this court's decision in Nevels 1? I think there is a subset question or a secondary question that is at least worth mentioning, which is, will this court be the first to expressly hold that an agency can interpret its own express preemption clause in a way that enlarges its reach? Because the U.S. Supreme Court has been offered a chance to decide that question. It's left it open. Admittedly, although I think Respondent's brief would suggest that there is some black letter law that you should defer to agencies when they interpret express preemption clauses, looking at the case law, reading it carefully, looking at all the scholarly writing in the last 20 years, what the circuit courts have said, it's an open question whether the U.S. Supreme Court would defer to an agency ever when it interprets
an express preemption clause. What should we read into their vacation and remand?
Nothing, Your Honor. I say that with some confidence. There's black letter law that a GVR is not the same as a reversal on the merits. And in fact, if you look at what was requested at the U.S. Supreme Court, both the U.S. United States filed an amicus brief, as they did here, and Coventry, they asked very specifically for this case. They certainly said they thought you were wrong. But they asked for the court to have the right to review this in the first instance in light of the new rule. And if you look at what the Supreme Court said, it handed the case back to this court, saying that it should have further consideration in light of the new regulations promulgated by OPM. And so that's what we have, is a Supreme Court giving this court the opportunity to see if anything changes. It was very clearly what was requested. It's very clearly what the Supreme Court did, expressed no criticism of this court's view. And so it makes sense. And in fact, I have the sort of unusual position of having stood before this court before in a very similar setting, in which there was a GBR, a grant vacate and remand, in a case called Brewer. It came back on Brewer 2. This court affirmed its overall position in that case, certainly looked at things and made some new conclusions, but reached the same result. There was a petition for certiorari in which they said the Missouri Supreme Court has ignored the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court denied the petition for certiorari.
But Brewer 2 was a situation on the arbitration where there were exceptions for unconscionability in the creation of the contract. In this case, they're talking about the term is deference. What kind of deference, given Chevron, do we give the administrative OPM?
I would suggest, Your Honor, that in this case, although I suggest you should give them no deference at all, the answer is, even if you gave them full Chevron deference, it wouldn't change the result. Let me walk through that very quickly for you. There's a number of hurdles here for OPM. The first is that, and I say OPM because certainly Coventry is the party before you, but OPM created the reg, and I think the U.S. is in many ways a party in interest, which is why they filed a brief. The first hurdle is the one I expressed, and they have to clear all of these. First, can you ever defer to an agency when it is opining not on things it's an expert about, but on the federal-state balance itself? We don't defer to agencies for fun. We defer to them because they're working within their substantive field. No one is suggesting that OPM has some special expertise in when it is appropriate to tread on Missouri law and when it isn't. And certainly OPM isn't subject to the same sort of debate we would see if, for example, this were sent to Congress.
But Chevron gives a lot of deference, so to speak, to the administrative agencies, does it not?
It does, Your Honor. Although Chevron, I think the question is, first, does Chevron get invoked? And what I'm suggesting is there is no case holding that Chevron deference applies when you're talking about an express preemption clause.
What does Chevron say it applies to? When an agency is acting within its field of expertise, is that what you're saying?
I would say that Chevron, a little more refined, says, I think that's why we defer. But Chevron itself suggests that we defer to the agency when there's an ambiguity and the agency's working within its delegated authority. And then, of course, we ask, was that conclusion sound? So the second hurdle, if we don't deal with whether you can defer, let's assume for a moment that sometime you could defer to an agency when it interprets the express preemption clause. It must have delegated authority. And this court anticipated that very issue in the first decision, Nevels 1. And in footnote 2, it said, we're not going to defer to your opinion letter. Because first, it's informal. It was in response to litigation. But the court doesn't stop there. Because it lays out the test. It says it has to be a formal rule, and you have to have authority. It says this is informal, not a formal rule. And then it says that there is, I would like to get this right, so let me just give it to you exactly. Well, I'll give it to you in paraphrase until I give it to you. Here it is. While informal agency interpretations of statute are relevant, there is no indication that Congress delegated to OPM the authority to make binding interpretations of the scope of FEBA preemption clause. So this court anticipated this issue and said, we don't see delegated authority. Now, that wasn't briefed as fully because there wasn't Chevron, potential for Chevron deference, there wasn't a rule. We briefed that extensively, and it's pretty clear there isn't a delegation of authority here. The only delegation that they point to at all is that this, the Office of Personnel Management may prescribe regulations necessary to carry out this chapter. That's the whole delegation they rely upon to do something that no court has blessed. And the U.S. Supreme Court has affirmatively avoided saying you can do, which is to receive deference, Chevron deference, to interpret your own express preemption clause. I would submit that if something this radical were allowed, it wouldn't happen under this general delegation clause. Certainly, if we look at the text of the clause, they may prescribe regulations necessary to carry out this chapter. But what they've done here is they've attempted to rewrite the chapter. They've attempted to make the chapter do something that certainly the plain language of the preemptive clause does not do, which is preempt subrogation and reimbursement. It's worth noting that in the entire body of ERISA on the mind, in the entire body of the Federal Employee Health Benefits Act, the words subrogation and reimbursement, although very commonly known to lawyers, not a sort of a rare breed, never appear. And if we look at the legislative history, even when they went back and said, let's amend this express preemption clause, let's make it reach a little further, subrogation and reimbursement don't appear in any discussion in any legislative history. What does appear is a discussion about the fact that some states are starting to require coverage of chiropractic care. They're mandating the type of benefits and coverage, and that is causing problems. There's even a discussion in the legislative history, we have it at page 25 of our appendix and 26, in which they're saying, if we don't pay for some of these particular benefits that states require, we could lose our license in that state because we're not honoring their laws. And so there's a very intentional displacement of benefits and coverage law. There is no discussion. I mean, I would say that if you talk to 100 lawyers, much less lawyers in Congress, most of them lawyers, and said, how should we preempt subrogation and reimbursement law? I can't imagine any of them would say, write down benefits and coverage. The reading that is being given here is at war with both the language of the preemption clause and at war with the legislative history, which is something new for this court because we did not have the legislative history fully briefed in the past. When you look at the legislative history and they talk about this clause as purposely limited, a limited form of preemption, well, then we have a problem because what we have here is agency alchemy. They've taken a limited preemption clause that the U.S. Supreme Court told us is puzzling because, as Judge Wilson and Judge Breckenridge noted, it allows contract terms to preempt state law. They say it's puzzling and we should interpret it cautiously. And it is a limited preemption clause, both by reading it, by looking at the Supreme Court decision, this court's decision, and the legislative history, and they turn it into an unlimited one. I would defy them to express a limitation that remains on substantive insurance law with the way they've read the clause. So the clause, if you imagine it, in my last few minutes here, I want to sort of do that. The clause itself says it preempts state law which relates to benefits or coverage and payment of benefits relating to insurance. They have taken that entire middle section, which relates to benefits and coverage, completely tossed it aside, so it now says it preempts state law that relates to insurance. Because all insurance law that has to do with substantive issues, and of course they're not preempting regulations, but that's expressly prohibited under FIBA and ERISA. What they have preempted is Mr. Neville's claim from start to finish. They've taken how he gets benefits, how he gets coverage, how much he has to pay for those benefits, which, by the way, is what payment with respect to benefits means, how much you pay and whether a state could mandate that you pay less. And then they've gone somewhere the clause never does, the subrogation and reimbursement. Now, how did they get there? They got there by tossing aside the presumption against preemption. But that's a problem. And if I did nothing else today, I want to implore this court to take a look at the opinion from the Sixth Circuit in a case called Carter. There's a concurrence by Judge Sutton. And take a look at the D.C. Circuit's Commonwealth of Massachusetts case. The D.C. Circuit, as you know, is in many ways the second most powerful court in the country, and it might be the most knowledgeable court on dealing with agencies because it handles over 50% of its dockets are agency questions because it sits in D.C. Those courts both said, even if we have an agency at play, and in fact, in Commonwealth of Massachusetts, they said, even if we give Chevron deference to what an agency says, we still check their interpretation against the presumption against preemption and other canons of interpretation. So look what happens when we do that here. We say, is this clause ambiguous? Yes. Should we apply the presumption against preemption? This court's already ruled. What does that mean? It means we read it narrowly. If OPM reaches the opposite conclusion, its construction, even if given Chevron deference, is unreasonable. And that's important because otherwise you mean that when you interpret a statute, Congress writes. We apply these interpretive principles. But if Congress were to create an agency, the agency would operate outside of these constitutional principles. That is not and cannot be the law. It would mean that Congress should always create another agency. There's already 50, we need 100, so that each time we have an agency, the court won't be able to apply interpretive principles. The agency will do as it likes, even if that flouts constitutional principles like the presumption against preemption or the constitutional avoidance doctrine. The jurists that have looked at this question, including the Sixth Circuit and D.C. Circuit, have said that is not the appropriate order. You don't get to throw out the canons of construction just because you're an agency, because if you did, you would become a super powerful agency that doesn't operate within the bounds that Congress and the court do. And I reserve the rest of my time.
May it please the court. Miguel Estrada for Coventry. Let me take the overarching themes of the presentation by Mr. Nevels and deal with them in turn. They are, there's a certain unseemliness about a federal agency purporting to overrule the judgment of a court. Number two, the interaction and the dynamic between the presumption against preemption and Chevron. And number three, the question of constitutionality. Bill none of the statute. On the first one, the entire answer to the argument of the unseemliness of a federal agency pretending to overrule the judgment of a court is given by the Supreme Court's opinion in Brand X. In that case, the Ninth Circuit had construed the Communications Act to say that cable modem service, what we use for Wi-Fi, had a certain statutory category. The Federal Communications Commission, which has a nearly identical delegation of authority to do things it thinks is necessary for the act, as is the case here, took a different view. Being no fools, people who disliked the rule of the FCC sued the FCC to invalidate the order in the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit said the agency does not have the power to have a different view of what we have done with the statute. The Supreme Court reversed. What the court held was as follows. When a statute gives delegated power to an agency to do things necessary to the ends of the act, as was here, as is, you know, the case here and was there, that is a delegation of authority to the agency under Chevron. A court may, in the absence of agency authority, give its best reading of the statute. But so long as the agency gives a reasonable reading, that has delegated authority from Congress behind it, and a court must defer.
Is that true in the preemption context? Have any cases addressed that?
That was going to be my next context. We have cited the Smiley case, which dealt with the National Banking Act, Section 85. The Supreme Court expressly stated that Section 85 was preemptive, And the ambiguity had to do with whether the term interest and the suit was going to be governed by federal law or by California state law. The court deferred under Chevron, even though under Section 85, whether the Banking Act would preempt, you know, the California statute was precisely what was at issue. Now, Mr. Neville says that was not a statute that affirmatively dealt with express preemption, and that question was saved. I don't think that's a fair reading of that case, but only 2 weeks later, in Medtronic versus Lohr, the Supreme Court dealt with an express preemption statute under the medical devices statute and quite clearly deferred under Chevron to the FDA's version of what Section 360K, which was the express preemption section, actually meant. And so that is a complete answer to the open question. But there's even something better, because, you know, the theme that overlies all of the scholars that have been cited by Mr. Neville's is this notion that there's, again, something unseemly with a federal agency using its delegated authority to expand its own authority. Now, you heard earlier that this is a question that the Supreme Court has left open. That is not so. In 2013, City of Arlington, Texas versus Federal Communications Commission, the question was whether whether the agency could use the delegated authority, which, as I think I have mentioned, is virtually identical to the statute here, to aggrandize its own power at the expense of the plaintiff, which is, I will remind you, City of Arlington, Texas. The whole issue there was the federal-state balance and who got to regulate certain transactions under federal law. The entire argument, and the court took the case solely on the question whether this delegated authority could be used under Chevron to aggrandize the agency's own jurisdiction. In a judgment by Justice Scalia with a dissent by the Chief Justice, the court said, yes, absolutely. The sole thing that matters is whether the agency has clear statutory authority, which is, again, nearly identical to that here, to do what is doing here. And the court actually thought, you know, there was no point in engaging in the deliberation and debate as to whether this issue is for the court or for the agency. And if I could read you from the opinion of the court just briefly, it says, in sum, judges should not waste their time in mental acrobatics needed to decide whether an agency's interpretation of a statute provision is jurisdictional or non-jurisdictional. Once those labels are sheared away, it becomes clear that the question in every case is simply whether the statutory text forecloses the agency's assertion of authority or not. Now, the court went on to give examples.
Does it have to be within the scope of what's delegated to them, what the statute addresses?
Yes, and you know, that relevant question here would have to be, what is the scope of Section 18, 89, 13? There was an implication in the argument earlier, which I had not seen in their briefs, that there is a limitation in the use of the word necessary in 89, 13 to imply that it has to be something sort of in the nature of essential or something at that level. But that's not true. That was, you know, the same word that was at issue in the Arlington case. And there is a long line of cases from the U.S. Supreme Court, again, beginning with a case called Mourning versus Family Publications, which deals with these sorts of statutes. And the holding of Mourning, is M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, is that these confer authority to do anything, quote, reasonably related to the purposes of the statute. Now, if OPM believes that its actions here are reasonably related to the purposes of the statute, which include the securing of health coverage at a low cost, that is sufficient under the statute.
Counsel?
But in the Mourning case was a truth in lending case, was it not?
Yes, I believe that's true.
And it was interpreting the consumer statute for giving authority and jurisdiction to the states regarding it. It was regarding class actions of a certain level of 1% or $500,000. And the statute was very clear, absolutely clear. And it really wasn't the regulations. It was the statute giving that authority to the state courts to implement.
Right, although it seems to me that so long as the languages of the statutes in which the Supreme Court found that deference is appropriate is comparable, the same rule would apply. I was on the verge of reading you one last passage from the City of Arlington case, and it dealt precisely with the question of preemption of federal law, and again with an FCC case that has the same necessary to the act language. And this is what the court said. We have even deferred to the FCC's assertion that its broad regulatory authority extends to preempting conflicting state rules. And so this vaunted question that has been saved since Miley has been very clearly answered by the U.S. Supreme Court in an opinion that is less than 2 years old. I looked for this case in Mr. Neville's brief, and I saw that he cited the dissent that Chief Justice Roberts penned, and that he cited Adams, the Adams case, the opinion on which the Chief Justice principally relied. But I did not see any forthright discussion of how it is that this case is not a complete answer to his main Chevron point. There is one other thing I should say, before my time is up.
Back to Mourning versus Family Publications. The statute was very clear about the jurisdiction, and as far as Reg Z, Regulation Z, and the different agencies control the currency and the Federal Reserve Board, of the absolute the interpretation of Reg Z would not go beyond the statute as far as attributing more authority than it may have had under the statute.
I think that's fair, Judge Teitelman, but it does seem to me that the ultimate answer to the problem here is whether the language in 8913 has conferred to the OPM the authority that the FCC exercised in those cases where the Supreme Court quite clearly held that the authority was broad enough. And just so that there is no ambiguity, FIBA says the Office of Personnel Management may prescribe regulations necessary to carry out this order. The FCC statute says to prescribe such rules and regulations as may be necessary in the public interest to carry the provisions of the Act.
If that case were dispositive, wouldn't we have expected the remand to be remanded to reconsider in light of City of Arlington as opposed to in light of the OPM regulation?
City of Arlington is a couple of years old, and City of Arlington is part of the legal background that gives OPM the authority to do what it did here. City of Arlington itself is an FCC case. It is not a rule of decision for you other than to meet the objection that the OPM's rule should not be applied because of want of authority. And so I think that, the Supreme Court proceeded appropriately in sending the case back to you for further consideration in the first instance of the impact of the rule. City of Arlington is highly relevant and I think dispositive of the contention that the rule cannot be controlling for want of authority. And that is why I'm asking, the court to take a look at it, because, the bulk of the submission on the other side is the proposition that the ordinary workings of Chevron should be disregarded here because there's something special when a federal agency seeks to aggrandize its power at the expense of state authority.
So we look at the context, for example, federal communications, telecommunications, that's fairly obvious that's interstate commerce, but we're looking at subrogation of insurance claims. That's something that's traditionally in the state's purview. It's not federal communications in that context, sure, that the federal government has absolute control over that, but you're talking about insurance subrogation cases. This is not the same kind of context.
I think I have two answers to that. I think to the extent that there is a question about the source of authority for the federal government to act in this field, I believe it ought to be manifest that the governance and control of the benefits available to its own workforce has enough of federal interest to provide for regulation. If memory serves, there was a time in which the Supreme Court of the United States in the 19th century in Paul versus Virginia held that insurance was not interstate commerce. That was changed ultimately. In its own judgment, Congress then chose to give that field back to the states in certain circumstances under the McCarran-Ferguson Act, for example, and under the insurance savings clause in the ERISA case. But there is no suggestion that there is a want of authority on the part of Congress to regulate these commercial transactions particularly when they affect its own workforce.
But the scholarship today is changing from Filburn. I mean, there's a lot of discussion, especially from the Chief Justice of the United States, regarding the effect of the Commerce Clause. I mean, it's not, one would say, the scholars might say, it's in flux as far as the Commerce Clause. It's not as absolute as it may have been after Filburn.
I think we know from the latest case from the Supreme Court on this subject that we cannot be made to eat broccoli by the federal government. But the relevant point for purposes of whether Congress has authority in this area is not whether insurance is interstate commerce, which I believe it is, but whether Congress has authority to regulate the rules that apply to benefits for its own workforce. Now, with that as a background, I do want to address the issue that Judge Wilson addressed.
I want to ask a question just a second. How many states have followed your position and allowed the OPM's action to overrule their state law?
The only case that has come down after the OPM is the Helfrich case, which from the 10th Circuit that we cited. The 10th Circuit cited with us on this question, did uphold, the OPM reg. It also disagreed with the prior opinion of this court to the extent that this court found that the presumption against preemption was relevant because it pointed out, as we did in our brief to the U.S. Supreme Court, that when you're dealing with the federal workforce, that is not an area of traditional state authority.
And have there been any decisions contrary to your opinion?
I don't believe so. There is a case in the Eighth Circuit that is pending on appeal, but I believe we were victorious in the district court. Is the Blue case, which I think is cited in our brief.
And before OPM's new ruling, were there cases going the other way?
You and the Cobalt case. The Cobalt case was vacated at the same time as your opinion was vacated. It has been briefed on remand from the Supreme Court.
Which court is that in?
Is in the Arizona Court of Appeals, which is the intermediate court in Arizona. That case is fully briefed and is scheduled for argument on January 7th. I know that I need to get to the arguments that have been made on the basis of Judge Wilson's earlier opinion. I will say that to some extent, this is a question of conceptualization. It is less rare than I believe you thought, Judge Wilson, that Congress will do what it did here. The Federal Arbitration Act, for example, says that the preemption goes, quote, to a written provision in any contract that provides for arbitration. We pointed out that there are, may I finish?
Yeah.
That there are a number of federal statutes that deal with preemption in terms of contracts, and I think it is not that the contracts themselves are thought to have preemptive force. It is the statute itself that displaces an area for the operation of those contracts under a system of federal law.
But under Brewer II, after Brewer I, the Supreme Court did not take cert. And basically in Brewer I, the Supreme Court said, well, it's in the creation of the contract, if there's unconscionability, that's part of the exception in the federal arbitration law. And again, we made a second decision in Brewer II, and the Supreme Court did not take that on cert.
Judge Teitelman, I don't disagree with my opponent's claim that the GVR was not a reversal, but merely sending the case back to you for further consideration, nor do I disagree with the proposition that the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court of the United States is purely discretionary.
There are other courts besides Missouri on Brewer II that decided the same way, and even federal courts decided the same way, that the exception in the preemption law for the construction, the creation of the contract was valid, and the Supreme Court has not taken any of those cases.
There is the Iskanian case from the California Supreme Court as well. I mean, the fact that the Supreme Court has not yet chosen to intervene to take an issue is not actually an affirmative demonstration that the rulings that
right,
it has chosen not to review are correct.
The Supreme Court could have reversed Brewer II, and they did not.
I understand that. And, the point that I was making is that with respect to the constitutionality question, Your Honor, the fact that many statutes share the same structure means that what Congress really is effectively not giving preemptive force to the contract itself, but clearing out an area of federal law for operation for these contracts. And I want to just I understand that the obvious objection to that is the McVeigh, you know, the part of McVeigh that dealt with whether there is or there isn't common law. And I think that there is an important distinction from what I just said and what was at issue in McVeigh. In McVeigh, you know, the question was twofold. You cannot come in as a plaintiff in federal court unless, A, there was federal question jurisdiction, and B, importantly, you had a cause of action. You have many federal cases in which statutes clearly govern, and the Supreme Court holds again and again that there is no private right of action.
I believe we had questions.
Well, you cite as an example the Federal Arbitration Act, but that gives a preemptive effect, or it will say that federal law will displace state law with respect to the rights and obligations of the parties to the contract. Is there a similar situation to what we have here where it's affecting somebody whose rights, who was not a party to the contract? What is given preemptive effect is a contract between the feds and the insurer. But Ms. Plaintiff, they haven't, as they would in the arbitration context, acceded to that. So is that... Yeah.
There is an area, and I think the complete answer to that, Judge Wilson, will be ERISA, a plan for federal, you know, a plan for health or pension benefits is a private contract usually between the employer and the insurer. There are people who benefit from it. Section 514 of ERISA clearly makes anything that is related to the plan preemptive. From time to time, there are people who try to sue, doctors usually, who are not remotely in privity with any of the parties in the contract, and their claims are routinely held to be preempted because Section 514 is taken to have created an area of federal law that deals with the plan, which is a species of a contract.
Well, to quote Judge Wolf, I know you're running out of time, as he said at one point, is there life day after Concepcion?
Well, the Supreme Court seemed to think so. I don't believe they would have given us a ruling that they thought was unfair.
I have one more question. Opposing counsel argued basically that even under Chevron, you only give deference if the agency interpretation is reasonable. And here it's not reasonable to read an intent to supplant state subrogation and reimbursement laws, because those are commonly understood words that are used in many statutes. They chose not to use them here. They used the word benefits. And if they wanted to cover subrogation, they would have said subrogation. That's a word that's well known and often used.
Seems to me that the complete answer to that is the Supreme Court's opinion in FMC, which deals with the ERISA statute, where the preemption also uses the word, you know, relates to the benefits under the plan, et cetera. And the very question whether subrogation was preempted under Section 514 went to the Supreme Court, which answered in the affirmative. And so,
based on an agency interpretation that it covered that?
Based on the language of the statute, I am prepared to ask you to reconsider your earlier ruling that the statute does not answer this in my favor unambiguously. But I am taking it as a given that you know that. I will simply point out that pretty much every plank of the argument has as an answer an opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, there is Smiley, City of Arlington, Brand X, FMC. All of these cases, these issues had been considered. If you were to accept and take up, the notion that this statute is unconstitutional under the construction that we urge, before you get to that question, this is, you know, my final point, there is a presumption that applies here as well. And it is that acts of Congress are presumed to be constitutional because members of Congress take the same oath as judges do. And there has to be a fairly affirmative and compelling demonstration.
We're talking about an act of an agency, not an act of Congress.
Well, I was addressing Judge Wilson's argument that because of its use of the contract language, the statute itself was unconstitutional. And if one were to frame what one have to decide in order to take on that question, one would have to start with the proposition that acts of Congress are presumed to be constitutional and that the party challenging constitutionality must affirmatively and compellingly demonstrate the contrary. That was, the sole point I was making.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Voice in my head there that was reminding me that I should do a good job for my client of remembering Occam's razor, that we should look for the simple solution. Respect Mr. Estrada's candor. I would expect no less from him that he doesn't see this as a vacating on the merits, but rather a chance to review your decision. The challenge there is that this court said, albeit in a footnote because it was not a central issue before, that while informal agency interpretations of statutes are relevant, there is no indication that Congress delegated to the OPM the authority to make binding interpretations of the scope of the Federal Employee Health Benefits Act preemption clause. That's what this court said. It didn't say it lightly. It's in the principal opinion that there isn't authority to make binding interpretations. The only way OPM or Coventry or the United States wins this case is if they have the authority to make not only an interpretation that receives deference, but one that this court must be bound by. I say that for two reasons. I mean, first, they don't have delegated authority. If we hold here today for the first time that a general delegation, like the one they have, which says you can make rules to implement the chapter, means that an agency can determine now when things are ambiguous and be deferred to, and then can determine its own preemptive reach, there is no left. I don't like slippery slope arguments, but that one's certainly true.
So, do you disagree with Mr. Estrada's interpretation of City of Arlington and Smiley? Then
I do. At pages 6 through 10 of our brief, we walk through this methodically in our reply. We did that because, with all due respect, I think the citations to Smiley are so piecemeal that it could say almost anything. It's Legos moved around in a sentence. When you read Smiley, it pretty plainly lays out the idea that there's a difference between a substantive clause and a preemptive clause. And it says, this argument that the agency is not entitled to deference confuses the question of substantive as opposed to preemptive. It goes on to say in the same paragraph, while what is at issue here is simply the meaning of a provision that does not, like the provision in Cipollone, deal with preemption, and hence does not bring into play the considerations petitioner arises. Well, what was in Cipollone? An express preemption clause that preempted some tobacco labeling, state tobacco labeling laws. And when we go to Cipollone, what did the court do? The court said, we apply the presumption against preemption. Even though we know this clause is an express preemption clause, of course it preempts something. We ask, law by law, does it preempt this common law claim? Does it preempt this common law claim? And we do all that through the lens of the presumption against preemption. In the 15 plus 7 minutes, which I think ended up being something like 22 minutes of argument, we didn't hear anything about the presumption against preemption. And that's precisely what OPM has cast aside. Because even if we said that they had that we could allow an agency, I think Smiley and then also City of Arlington, which does not deal with an express preemption clause. I agree that Judge Scalia talks about jurisdictional issues. He doesn't get to this ultimate question. And we can read the tea leaves from Smiley and from earlier cases, and we can guess. But at the end of the day, even if an agency could be deferred to in some setting, we would not expect to find it in a general delegation. And even if they cleared the second hurdle, they have a delegation of authority, which they do not, they would still have to interpret it in a way that this court deems reasonable. And what is reasonable? Well, it has to, at a minimum, comply with the canons of construction. And so it's interesting that the two cases that have dealt with this, Commonwealth of Massachusetts and Carter, which comes out of the Sixth Circuit. By the way, Carter was handed down after City of Arlington. And in the concurrence, Judge Sutton, a respected judge, thinks about these things carefully, begged the court to look at that analysis because that's the weight of reason. He walks through it and he says, listen, we ask, is there an ambiguity? And then we ask, is that ambiguity resolved by our principles of construction? And then we get to the agency. Because if we do it the other way, We risk deferring to the agency and allowing the agency to avoid constitutional doctrine. I mean, the presumption against preemption isn't judicial creation. It arises in the judiciary, but it is born of the Constitution. It is a check on federal run over states, and it is a way to ensure federalism is preserved. If the agency, which agrees, I mean, they've conceded that they didn't consider the presumption against preemption. There's nothing in their rulemaking about it. They tossed this court's analysis about the presumption against preemption aside and then created their own rule. If I could just finish this point, I know I'm over, but I wanted to certainly mention, it's interesting that the other case, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts case, which comes out of the D.C. Circuit in the 90s, it actually applies a sort of different order, but reaches the same result. And that's why even if you gave this Chevron deference, the result wouldn't change. In that case, it says, okay, I believe it was the Department of Transportation in that case, has made an interpretation. And they say it's an open question whether they can interpret an express preemption clause at all. They say why it's an open question, at least then. And they say, but we're going to assume Chevron deference for a moment. We're going to give them Chevron deference. Now, they've interpreted this clause to mean this. But the presumption against preemption would result in the opposite conclusion, and so they do not defer, and they cast aside the agency's interpretation even when given Chevron deference.
We'll read the cases. Counsel, if you have cited during your argument any cases that are not in your brief, please submit a letter both to the court and to opposing counsel with those cases in the cite.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Case is submitted.